So, David, thank you.
Thank you for having me. I tend to be very soft-spoken, so if you can't hear me, let me know by... Well, I get do this. If you just raise your hand, I'll think you have a question, but if you do this, wave your hand, then I'll know you can't hear me, and I'll try to speak up. I carry this lemon ginger tea with me all the time to keep my voice functional, so you'll see me drinking from this a lot, and hopefully that'll help me to project. I mean, since I'm a university professor, you'd think that this would be no particular problem. But most of us are old enough, most of us in this room are old enough to get it, that, you know, it's like, that was then and this is now, and the way things were then and the way things are now are not necessarily exactly the same. As a matter of fact, they're almost certainly not the same, which I guess in a certain sense is a segue into my talk. I hadn't really thought about that, but sometimes our minds lead us in directions that we wouldn't have thought of if we tried to think about it, but that they work out pretty well. I guess that sounds sort of Zen. Okay, so the title of this talk is Autonomy and Interdependence. And I picked the word interdependence because it sort of means something to people. It's not actually a word that you would find in traditional Buddhist literature, so I'll explain that. But I thought that it would look good on a poster or in a newspaper, so that was why I picked it. So I have some notes that I want to refer to once in a while, because the other thing about impermanence, since that's sort of what we're talking about here in a way, is memory. And what we remember to do, and if we organize a talk, how much do we remember, and how much do we need notes for? So I have some notes. So let me actually begin a long time ago. I actually want to go back to shortly after the time of the Buddha to start this talk. And in fact, that period of time is relevant to our own time. In ways that might be unexpected. There are some theorists that are of the view that the sense of I as concrete ego or concrete person really first emerged in different parts of the more advanced cultures of the world around 600, 400 BC. And that as a consequence, religions organized themselves to deal with that, and societies organized themselves to deal with that around the same time. Now, there are other views about the causal relationships of all of this, and you know, different people support these views or don't. In a sense, it doesn't matter. But the Buddha and the Buddhists of the first couple centuries after him were particularly concerned with the problem of what is a self, what am I? And this is a problem that was really exercising the minds of the philosophers of India at the time, very extensively. Now, when we think of India, we think of India as a very poor country, a country that's sort of stressed by poverty and whatnot. But the India of 2,500 years ago was lush and wealthy. The India of 2,500 years ago, maybe we shouldn't even call it India, but the Indic world of 2,500 years ago was so wealthy by the standards of that period of time that it could support a class of philosophers. My friend Bob Thurman, who teaches at Columbia, likes to say that basically India supported a permanent class of hippies. And that's because he's an old hippie, so he likes to say that, and he kind of thinks, you know, that'd be a nice thing if America would do that, but unfortunately we have to become college professors if that's what we want to do instead of being hippies. And some of us do that in a big way, as he did, and some of us do it more modestly. Anyway, the big thing that was exercising their mind was, what is a person? What is a self? And in this world, they drew a number of different conclusions, and then they debated this. One of the things that's really kind of interesting about the ancient world is people had the time and the inclination, if the circumstances were right, to get together and talk about these issues and debate these issues. And I'm going to read you a dialogue at a certain point that is recorded of one of these older conversations. Most of the peoples of India were of the conclusion that the self was something permanent, that I is something that exists, that has a concrete, definite nature, and that it doesn't change over time. And most importantly, that after I die, I am still going to exist. That was the big thing. What happens to me when I die? So I'm still going to exist when I die, and that's what people wanted to believe, we might say. And so they developed these ideas. But the basic idea was that the Indians were looking for what's permanent. They said what's real is what's permanent. And so to find what's real in me, I need to look at what's permanent in me. And they were of the conclusion that there was something in me, an I, a me, that was permanent and that was also conscious. These things went together in their view. And on this idea, we have the notion of reincarnation, because if I'm conscious and I'm permanent, the body may die, but this conscious, permanent thing is going to stick around, so it's going to take on a new body. But not everybody had that thought. Not everybody had that point of view. So the other thing that was going on in ancient India was the practice of yoga. Yoga is just a technology for gaining control of the mind and looking closely at what's going on internally. So there was a lot of time that people had to practice yoga because, again, as my friend Bob likes to say, you know, you could sit around and practice yoga, you could meditate, and when you got hungry, you took your bowl out and somebody would give you lunch because there was enough food around. You didn't have to worry about it. The weather was warm enough, you didn't have to wear a down parka or something like that when the winter came. You know, everything would be good. I think he's a little bit idealist about some of these things, but it makes the point. Now, this became the prevailing view in most Indian thought. And a metaphor that I like to share with students for this is if you were standing by the edge of a lake and you were looking out toward the west as the sun was setting, and there was a little bit of a breeze, and as the sun's going down, you see what we call scintillations on the lake. We've all had this experience. One sun, but many little sparkles on the lake. So the idea that they had was God, which they called Brahman, that there was a God that was all-encompassing, was like the sun that was in the sky, and the scintillations were like all of us in this room. So the same God was in all of us. But it appeared that there was a different light in all of us because we're all these different scintillations. But there's really only one God. And it's due to circumstance, perspective, the waves on the lake, that you have the appearance of these different scintillations. So that became a very prevalent way of thought in the Indian world. If you're interested in these things, technically the school of thought that held this point of view is called Vedanta. Now, to Buddhism. So the Buddha was somebody who had it all. He wasn't exactly the Bill Gates of his time. He was born a prince. But he basically, according to the stories, had it all. He was wealthy, lived what was considered a luxurious life. His dad took good care of him. There are various stories about why this happened that I won't go into. But at a certain point, he kind of thinks, wait a minute, there's something wrong. And there are stories about why that is. He saw people get old. He saw people get sick. He saw people die. He said, oh, everything isn't great. You know, for those of you who I've spent any time in California, this isn't Marin County. If that might mean something to some people, you know. This is not Sausalito. There's something else going on here. That might speak more to my ideas of paradise than anything else. But anyway, so he became a wandering yogi. He could get his free lunch. He became a wandering yogi, and he learned the practice of meditation under various masters. And then he looked very closely within himself to try and figure out what was going on, to address what he considered the problems of being me and being finite. Because he didn't just take it for granted that this idea that I'm permanent, that God is within me and God is unchanging and I'm permanent, he didn't take it for granted that that was true. He was empirical. if you will, to use that kind of language. He really wanted to investigate this for himself, believing that unless he could directly experience something for himself, it was only hearsay. So why should he believe it if somebody else said it? I want to know it directly myself. So he was a master meditator, and he looked closely at what was happening. And when we talk about the Buddha getting enlightened, what this really means is he had a, aha, I got it. I saw what's really going on here. And what he saw was interesting because it completely contradicted the prevailing view of the time. He said, oh, this I, this self, is not permanent. This I, this self, is very transitory. It's constantly changing. As a matter of fact, it's totally not what we think it is. So that was a radical departure from the times. Now, to indicate how radical a departure was, let me use an example from sort of modern language, modern parlance, modern psychology. We talk about our minds, we talk about states of mind. I'm in a good mood, I'm in a bad mood. But generally the way we talk about things is my mind, and it goes through various states. Sometimes I feel better, sometimes I feel worse. But that's common language. Everybody's heard this about state of mind. Am I wrong? That's pretty much, yeah, okay. If you look at the way, say, the Tibetans would say this, they wouldn't say this state of mind changed to that state of mind. What they say is this mind became that mind. They talk about moments of mind. They don't talk about a mind that is constant and changes its character over time, right? Like a room that's light and gets darker and gets lighter and gets darker, and the amount of light changes, but the room is the same. They say different minds, different moments of mind. Okay. Now, so take a minute to think about the difference between these two ways of talking about what appears to be the same phenomenon. Different minds, different states of mind. So what's the obvious difference there? Any takers?
No permanence to the self.
No permanence to the self, no permanence to the state of mind. So I'm like my straight guy or something, right? I sort of clued you what the answer was going to be. Right. Yeah. We have the idea that we are a constant something. This is how we view the I, and that constant something changes over time. The Buddha's experience was, that's not what's happening. What's happening is in each moment, what appears to be a consistent I is changing over time. And there are different somethings in each moment. So here's a metaphor for you about this. These lights in this room are neon lights, okay? So hopefully you understand. Maybe you don't. I'm going to explain this. Neon lights, sometimes you can see them flicker when the ballast is not very good. The way neon lights work is they flip on and off 60 times a second. That's electricity goes through the circuits at 60 cycles a second. That's so fast that it seems like consistent light to us. But in fact, these lights are flickering on and off all the time. The Buddha's view, we just can't see it. It's below the level of our perception, unless it's malfunctioning. The Buddha's view was that the human person, the self, the I, whatever that is, we haven't really gotten to what that is yet, but whatever that is constantly changing in a stream of moments, and that the changes are so fast we don't notice them. So we make a mistake in thinking that I am consistent over time. Now that might, if you seriously meditate on that, that might seem very disturbing to you. I mean, there's an alternative interpretation, but at first blush, that might seem very disturbing to you. Okay, with that metaphor in mind, then, what does this have to do with the Buddha's take on the main human problem? Because what is that? For some people it might be, do I survive after this death? For some people it might be something else. And at that time they said the main problem that they were looking at was what we would call dissatisfaction. unhappiness, ill-easeness. Whatever I do, it doesn't work out. There's probably nobody that is sitting here. It's always dangerous to say this. There's probably nobody that's sitting here that's completely satisfied with what's going on in their life. I mean, there might be. That would be great. But most often, if I'm sitting in a room of people, and I usually teach college students, so this is kind of an interesting issue, you know. We're not completely satisfied. Something's wrong. You know, there's something wrong. Something bugs us. Something's kind of chewing away at us. You know, it's like my wife says, "I'm never satisfied." It's like if I lived in a different place, everything would be good. If I only had another X thousand dollars, everything would be just great. I have friends who are sure that if they could only win the lottery, life would be wonderful. And I don't know. I mean, if you look at the lives of lottery winners, I'm not sure whether or not that's so true. Anyway, yeah, last night we were watching a movie called Blue Jasmine. And someone wins the lottery, gets $200,000, goes out to a visit with their sister and brother-in-law, and gets ripped off for their $200,000. Right? It's like, okay, this, you know, it's the way stuff is going to be. Okay. How do these things relate to each other? Buddha's looking for the answer to the question of everything's changing, everything is impermanent. And somehow that relates to the fact that we're dissatisfied, that we're looking for something, that we're ill at ease in some particular way. And basically his answer to that is that the belief in permanence, the belief in I as autonomous, is at the root of our feeling a quality of dissatisfaction. And that somehow, if we really understood what I was, this dissatisfaction problem would go away. That the dissatisfaction problem is based upon having wrong ideas about the idea of what am I. And I think there's a certain logic to this, if you think about it. If you have an erroneous notion of who I am, how are you ever going to make I happy? You're busy trying to make something happy that isn't what it appears to be. So you can't make yourself happy if you don't know who you are, we might say in our language. And the Buddha's saying, you don't know who you are because you're so different than what you think you are. You think you're permanent, but you're not. Okay, is this making some degree of sense? Okay. Tea time. Now, let me read you a story. I said that in ancient India, some class of people had time on their hands. They were the renunciates, or the monks. The Buddha founded the first monastic order in the world that we know of nuns and monks. And originally they wandered around. Eventually they settled, and the first monasteries and nunneries were created. So these people lived very simply, and so they were like hippies that had places to live. And they could spend their time meditating and studying philosophy and getting engaged in dialogue and whatnot. Something else that happened in the ancient world, you know the name Alexander the Great? That'll seem like a right. Wait, what does this have to do with India? Well, Alexander actually conquered not only the Persian world, as it was called at the time, what we would call Iran, but also his armies went into Afghanistan, as we would call it now, and actually came down through the Khyber Pass into the Indus Valley, and they didn't do very well, and they had to leave, but they did get there. And what Alexander did when he left some region was he left some troops behind, and he established kingdoms where he left. And even after Alexander left that part of the world, the kingdoms endured. So in what we would now call Afghanistan, there were Greek ruling dynasties in Afghanistan. And among the Greeks, you were a slouch if you didn't have a court philosopher. So all these ruling dynasties had a court philosopher. They didn't have television, so what was the king doing if he wasn't busy conquering whoever was next door, hanging out with his wives or whatever and playing polo and what have you. If he had any brains, he spent his time with a court philosopher or philosophers. And they would have debates. And this was their form of entertainment. Okay. Buddhism eventually made its way into Afghanistan. So what ended up happening is that the Greek successor kings, who were very oriented toward Greek philosophy, started having dialogues with these Buddhists that were appearing in their environment. And some of these dialogues have been maintained, and they're very interesting. And so I want to read you one of them. Now, this particular translation was done during Victorian times, so it contains some elements that sound a little bit strange from the point of view of the way we speak English. But I happen to like it because there's a degree of charm to the way they translated that's not quite so matter of fact. I've modified some of the most charming elements because they're just too Victorian, a little bit weird to us. But let me read you this dialogue. It'll take just a few minutes. And it's about a monk by the name of Nagasena and a king by the name of Milinda, or in the Pali scripture, Milindapada, but his name was Milinda. And Milinda was the king of one of these areas, and this famous monk, Nagasena, is around there, and the king wants to meet him. But this monk is so esteemed that the king goes to meet him. He doesn't send a messenger and say, come to the palace, which would have been more typical. He goes out to meet him. So that's a sign of this is a very extraordinary person. So that's sort of the context. And they're having a long dialogue, and then this particular passage occurs in the dialogue. Pardon me while I take my glasses off so I can read this. And the venerable Nagasena said to Milinda the king, how did you come, on foot or in a chariot? So everyone knows what a chariot is, like two-wheeled vehicle pulled by some horses. If you've seen the movie The Ten Commandments, Cecil B. DeMille, chariots were sort of like that. You know what those chariots look like. King says, I did not come, sir, on foot. I came in a carriage. Well, he means chariot. Then if you came, sire, in a chariot, explain to me what that is. Is it the pole that is the chariot? King, I did not say that. Nagasena, is it the axle that is the chariot? Certainly not. Is it the wheels, or the framework, or the ropes, or the yoke, or the spokes of the wheels, or the goad that are the chariot? And to all these, he, the king, Milinda, still answered no. Then is it all these parts of it that are the chariot? I'll repeat that. Then is it all these parts of it that are the chariot? Milinda, the king, says no, sir. But is there anything outside them that is the chariot? And still he answered no. So then Nagasena says, I mean, they got to think about this, right? This monk is talking to this king. This is what he says. Then thus, ask as I may, I can discover no chariot. Chariot is a mere empty sound. What then is the chariot you say you came in? It is a falsehood that your majesty has spoken, an untruth. He's calling the king a liar. This is really nervy. There is no such thing as a chariot. You are king over all India, a mighty monarch. Well, that's an inflation. Of whom, then, are you afraid that you speak untruth? And he called upon the Yonakas, these are the local people, and the brethren to witness, saying, Milinda the king here has said that he came by chariot. But when asked in that case to explain what the chariot was, he is unable to establish what he declared. Is it possible to approve him in that? When he had spoken thus, the 500 Yonakas, that's the audience, like you folks, shouted their applause and said to the king, now let your majesty get out of that if you can. Right? So, I mean, think about this, right? A monk and a king. Imagine you go to, you have a conversation with Bill Gates rather than Barack Obama. And you have a debate and you say, ha, I got you. And everybody there says, yeah, he's got you. See if you can get out of that. Never mind, I was reading about Bill Gates this morning. He's on my mind. Okay, get out of that if you can. And the Melinda, the king, replied to Nagasena and said, I have spoken no untruth, sir, reverend sir. It is on account of its having all these things, the pole and the axle, the wheels and the framework, the ropes, the yoke, the spokes, and the goad, that it comes under the generally understood term, the designation in common use of chariot. Nagasena says, very good. Your Majesty has rightly grasped the meaning of chariot. And just even so, it is on account of all those things you questioned me about, the 32 kinds of organic matter in a human body, the 5 constituent elements of being, that I come under the generally understood term, the designation in common use of Nagasena. For it was said, sire, by our sister Vagira in the presence of the Blessed One, that's the Buddha, just as it is by the dependent arising and coexistence of its various parts that the word chariot is used, so is it that when the aggregates of a person are there, we talk of a being I. Okay? So maybe that was too much of a story. But it's kind of an interesting story. You know, these old guys are getting together and they're having this conversation. And basically the way it goes is, you are what you are because you are a mere collection of parts. A body, a mind, memories, passions, and so on and so forth. You are what you are simply because all these parts have come together at this point in time, and a name is designated on those parts, David, Thatcher, whatever the case may be. A name is designated on those parts, and then because you forget that that's what's going on, or because you don't notice that that's what's going on, you think that's a concrete, coherent whole, and you think you are permanent, and you're not. So this is the dialogue of the times. Okay. Now, half this room is somewhat gray. Okay. And the nice thing about getting old is we know the truth of this. It's a little bit harder to see when we're 20. Believe me, it was really hard for me to understand that all these parts that are hanging together were going to head south, fall apart, and go all kinds of different directions, and that I was made of parts, because I thought I was, you know, I rode a motorcycle at night on the Pacific Coast Highway, and I was indestructible, and if it was foggy, it was better. I don't do that anymore. Well, besides the fact I live in La Grande, I know a lot of motorcycle riders in La Grande. I'm not one of them. Believe me, I know I'm not indestructible. These parts don't hang together so well. They require a lot of care and attention for all these parts to hang together. Okay, so here's the main point, though. All these things, in truth, all of us, we are a collection of elements that are held together over a period of time, and we forget that. And not only that, if we ask what it is that's holding this collection of parts together, in our minds, it's the idea that we're a whole because we don't look at the collection of parts. But if we look at ourselves from the point of view of objective reality, what holds all the parts together, what the Buddhists like to call the transitory collection, how's that for a name for yourself, the transitory collection? What holds the transitory collection together is it arises in dependence on causes. Now, Buddhists understand causality very well. When we talk about causality, we talk about cause and effect. We like to start with a cause in the past and go to the effect in the present or the future. Buddhists like to talk about that sometimes, but mostly what they like to talk about is that which is in the present arises or occurs depending upon something that happened in the past. They look at it from the other way around. And there are very interesting, significant reasons for that. Because when we look at cause and effect, we think of one cause having multiple or a single effect. But if you think of dependent arising, you're looking at what appears to be one effect, but it could have multiple causes. Right? So a tree, for example, exists in the present because of sunlight in the past, earth in the present, water in the past, right kind of atmosphere in the past, a certain seed certain kind of tending, not too many deer or a nice fence around the tree. Again, you can see where I live, a lot of deer. Find deer in Le Grand walking up and down the streets all the time. They live in my backyard. I walk out and they're, never mind. okay, so if you think about things from that point of view, what Buddhists call dependent arising, then you recognize that this collection, which is me, exists in the moment dependent upon many other factors, both in the past and in the present. So if you think this way, what are the consequences of thinking this way? See? Now, the way we think about ourselves as autonomous. I mean, that's the American way, isn't it? Rugged independence, rugged individuality. There's nothing fundamentally wrong with that. I don't really think there is. But we think of ourselves as this autonomous capsule. Alan Watts liked to talk about the skin-encapsulated ego, the skin bag around an ego. And he liked to be provocative in that way. I don't much like that metaphor. But it communicates. We think of ourselves as independent, as autonomous, and disconnected from everything, and we can get along on our own. And even if we think that way, if we take a minute to think about it, we know it's not true. But we mostly don't like to think about it. Okay? But the Buddhist point of view is to emphasize the truth of that matter. And the reason for emphasizing the truth of that matter is, on the one hand, it's a deep way of understanding not just that change is the truth of things, that impermanence is the truth of things, but there's something, in a sense, that's even more important than that. Because just as a tree is dependent upon the water and the sun and so on and so forth, what are we dependent on? Now, we're dependent on the water and the sun too. There's no question about that, although we tend to forget that. And we also tend to forget about the fact that what we do has consequences. That's the other side of all of this, the downstream element. If you're ecologically oriented in your thinking, you understand that this problem of permanence has very interesting consequences, because we not only don't understand the complexity of the current situation and where we come from and what we depend on, we don't understand the real consequences of our actions, right? We don't understand the downstream consequences of the complexity of the existence that we are. I like to think about Hanford when I talk about this. That's sort of like a downer when you really know what's going on in Hanford. But you know, we can't just bury stuff and it's going to go away just because we don't want to look at it. You know, we exist in a very complex flow of past, present, and future. So we depend on all these things, and we misunderstand who we are and what's going to make us happy because we don't understand this. This is the Buddhist view. But what else do we depend on for our happiness? Each other, right? This is the basis for the Buddhist view of altruism as the prime social value and ethic, right? As the Dalai Lama says, if you really look into yourself and you look for happiness, you can look into yourself and find peace of mind, say if you know how to meditate. And he's very good at that. He deals with very complex stuff all the time, responsible for a lot of stuff that's really difficult to deal with, and he's a real jovial guy. You know, because he can sort of like, this is what's going on in me, this is what's going on around me, and I can be seated in myself and have some peace of mind and be happy. But he also says, in truth, because of the way we're so profoundly and deeply interconnected, where our happiness in the end really comes from, if we look, is it comes from others. It doesn't just come from ourselves. Because we're really so profoundly and deeply connected with others that when we look at it, we find our happiness really comes from others. Where I live, there's a beautiful lake in the hill up above where I am called Morgan Lake. It's about a 20-minute drive from my house in Le Grand. I love to go up there when there's not snow on the ground because I can't get up there when it's snowing. I like to sit by the lake and look out over the lake at Mount Emily in the distance, and it's just beautiful and it's peaceful, and I can just sit there for the longest time until mosquito season comes. and everything is wonderful. And after about 2 hours, what I really want to do is drive down the hill and go home because I know my wife is there waiting for me. And it would not be good if I couldn't go home and my wife wasn't there waiting for me. And if she's out shopping, just, you know, the other side of town at the Safeway, I'm really not very happy, because I wanted to go home and have her there because I wanted to see her. Okay. Simple example of this. All of our happiness depends upon others. And if we really see that, if we really look, we really see that. And it's built into existence because of our nature. Because our nature is made of parts, we're transitory, and the parts are connected and held together by the larger environment. And that larger environment includes others. So one of the consequences of this is, what do we do? How do we act? How do we deal with what goes on downstream, what goes on in the future, and so on and so forth? Okay. So this is the basis of Buddhist ethics. Back to the Buddha and the original problem of identity and self. So we might think, oh, okay, I'm a transitory collection, so when I die, it's all over. It's the big sleep. Well, the Buddha came to the opposite conclusion. He came to the conclusion that the Vedantins were wrong when they said everything is permanent. He said, no, nothing's permanent. So how is it possible, then, that Buddhists believe in reincarnation? If everything's constantly changing and we're made up of parts and moments of consciousness, moments of mind, you would think when death comes, it's all over. The parts fall apart, it's all over. He said, no. What is it that holds all the parts together? Something is holding all the parts together. We may name it to understand it, but something's holding all the parts together. And because we exist in a series of moments, it's not like there's any point in that series of moments where non-existence, total non-existence, enters in. Because if you exist as a series of moments, one moment you exist, the next moment apparently you don't exist, like the light flashing on and off. You exist, you don't exist, you exist, you don't exist, you exist, you don't exist. I know this is metaphysical, so you'll have to take it on faith. Right? You exist, you don't exist, you exist, you don't exist. So what does that mean? According to the Buddha, what it means is there is no moment when non-existence becomes a permanent condition, because there isn't anything permanent. So to think there's permanent non-existence would just be another illusion. It's momentary non-existence followed by another moment of existence. Now, this cannot be proved logically. I mean, logically I can explain it, but it doesn't prove it. You're not going to buy it because, and I'm not actually trying to sell it to you, I'm just trying to tell you the story, right? But it's not going to work for you, even as a story, unless you can experience it yourself. And the whole Buddhist way is go out there and check it out. See if you can experience it yourself. Here's the theory. Here's the way we talk about things. Here are the concepts. Now what you need to do is do the experiment. Sit down, meditate, look really closely, find out what you see. Buddhism is a really interesting religion because the Buddha said, don't believe anything I said because I said it. Believe it because you could ascertain for yourself its truth based on your own experience. That you can ascertain that it's true based on your own experience. There are not many religions that say things like that. Right? It's one of the things I like about Buddhism. But the downside is you've got to do the experiment. It's like you can't become a biochemist unless you work in the lab and find out how to do the experiments, right? If you're going to be a nuclear physicist and you want to figure out something about the nature of matter, you've got to build CERN and other kinds of cyclotrons. You've got to do the experiments, right? So there you have it. You've got to do the experiment. And maybe you can get the answer from doing the experiment. Or maybe you don't want to take the time and do the experiment. And then if you're a person of faith, it might be, hey, well, logically that sounds good. Or if you're a person of logic, logically it sounds good. If you're a person of faith, you might think, well, the Dalai Lama seems like a pretty jovial person no matter what's going on. Maybe he knows something that's worth knowing that I don't know. I'll check it out and I'll try it just because it looks good. So I'm not very experimental myself, although I do meditate regularly. And I can't say that for myself the direction that I went was I'll sit down and experiment, and I saw the 60 cycles a second of things changing, and I know that I'm impermanent and everything is good. I went the other direction. I went the direction of, he seems like a pretty jovial guy. I'd like to know what he knows, because I'd like to be able to feel that way. You know, I'd like to be able to feel that way. So that's another approach. It doesn't sound much like a college professor approach, but it's improved things for me. And it's improved my relationship with other people to think this way. And I'm not sure that I would be in a position to say it's true, that it has improved my relationships with other people to think this way. But my wife claims it's true. She ought to know, because she's put up with me for almost 30 years now. So she says, yeah, it works. So thank you very much. I appreciate your being here. Now, Janaki has asked, would I do a short meditation with you all? Okay? So we'll do something really simple, if you like. If you don't want to, that's okay, too. You don't have to do anything. And but maybe it's not so good that you get up and leave, because that'll disturb the people who are staying here. So here's what the short meditation is. If you just sit straight in your chair, and this part is important, although I'm sitting here slouching as I'm talking to you, you do want to hold your back erect, and you want to have your feet on the floor flat. And what you want to do is you want to notice yourself breathing. And that's pretty much all you want to try and do. Now, that's going to be a challenge, because if your back is bothering you, or if you're too warm, all that stuff's going to happen. But really what you want to try and do is you want to try and notice the breathing that's going on. And try and only notice the breathing that's going on. So let's just do that for a minute. Doesn't matter if your eyes are open or closed. If your eyes are closed and you tend to fall asleep, you might want to open them. And if your eyes are open and you feel like you're going to be distracted, you might want to close them. There are no hard rules here. But let's just breathe together for a few minutes. Now, one thing that certainly happens, don't stop breathing, but one thing that certainly happens, as if you could stop breathing, one thing that certainly happens is as soon as you try and focus on your breath and on simply breathing, your mind will start spinning all kinds of stories. And it could be anything from my foot itches to my back bothers me to it's too warm to I wish he'd shut up or whatever the case may be. But your mind will have this stuff going on. And it's in the nature of mind to tell you stories and to have ideas. And meditators know that it's not going to stop. One Zen priest I know wrote that just as it's the job of kidneys to excrete waste, it's the job of your mind to excrete thoughts. So it's not going to stop. But you can get caught by the thought or not. You can let the thought go. You can let the train of thoughts go. And just go back to noticing your breathing. And a metaphor that I think is really nice for this is if you think of thoughts as like clouds, they just sort of float across the sky. And that doesn't bother you here on Earth. And you can just let those cloud thoughts float across the sky of your mind and go back to your breathing. So try doing that for a while. Okay. So you all thought when you came here that you were who you were, but now I'm going to inform you that you are all Zen practitioners, because that's what you were doing. That's called Zen. And you're now all Zen meditators, for better or worse, greater capacity or less. That's all there is. So when you want some peace of mind with your own mind, you can do this. Sit in a chair, sit cross-legged, sit comfortably. Pay attention to your breath. It's always going to be there. And let your mind just do what it's going to do. It's going to tell its stories, and it's going to float along and just clouds. Just let the clouds go by and relax. Now, of course, if you wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning and your mind is bugging you and you can't get to sleep and that's what you'd really like, it might be more useful to go and make yourself a nice hot cup of tea and a slice of toast with too much butter on it. Might do a whole lot better when you go back to bed to get back to sleep. But from the point of view of day in and day out, you can do this. It's really very easy. It's basic. And all of Buddhist practice is based upon what you've already got at hand and what you really are. So, there you have it. That's your takeaway. And thank you for having me. And have a good day.
So, thank you, everybody, for coming.